Welcome to the 40K Lorecast.
Welcome to 40K Lorecast. I'm John Barsani and Brad Chester.
This guy.
Today, we're going to close out our coverage of the dumbest of the Primarchs, Conrad Gruss.
Oh, my God. Punch you right in your throat. Throat punch.
Yeah. With his death and his legion turning basically into the Starscream of 40K. That's what they are. They're just a bunch of, they make a ton of noise. They do little things, but then they just get their butts kicked a lot. Like, there's an amazing side character in stories.
Sometimes you just got to pick up Megatron and take him somewhere.
Yeah, Megatron. Rah.
Anyway, all right. The 40K Lorecast, weekly show in the lore of the Warhammer 40K universe, releasing every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Please follow and comment. It does help us out a lot, so I really appreciate when you guys do it. It boosts our algorithm and helps push out to more listeners. We have a YouTube channel. Check it out. Bi-monthly, tri-monthly, eventually monthly Q&As, along with additional content whenever Brad gets around to it. if you like the show, sorry, Brad's giving me the finger. if you like the show, check out our other show, The History of 40K. We talk about the history of the game of Warhammer 40K on the tabletop. Really fun time, mostly talking about how this game used to be played, all the different editions, a lot of us just complaining about how things used to be while admitting that it also is incredibly broken and stupid. The usual. And if you like the sound of my voice, come check me out in Retro Recall, where I play impossibly hard games like Aladdin. Why? Why? Why would a Disney game be that hard? Why? Anyway, but if you want to help us out, we have two ways to help us out. One, you can go to our website, the40klorecast.com, and check out our merchandise for some pretty cool t-shirts, stickers, dice, objective markers. Sorry, guys, I didn't realize GW was going to make them invalid, but let's see how long they last on that one, because they've done that before, and they came right back around. Or you can help us out via Patreon. Patreon's a great way to support us. It helps Brad and I do other cool things, like expand out into YouTube, get better editors, kind of do more stuff. Our Patreon's really simple. It's $4.99 a month. You guys get this show and the history of 40K ad-free, or 3.69 pounds sterling, because today we're going to Manchester, named by the Romans after a hill nearby that they thought looked like a breast, because Italians are going to Italian. And at that point, it was named Mamusian, because for whatever reason, they did it in the accusatory male declension of us a. And if you guys can't conjugate Latin, that's on you, because I still can, because I did that in school. Manchester has been a key point in manufacturing England since the early days of the Industrial Revolution, the early 1800s, starting with the textiles, and that pushed all the way through industrial manufacturing. Did leave their rivers a little bit dirty. That happens. And it's actually been a really cool spot for a lot of innovation. It was the birthplace of vegetarianism under William Cowherd, birthplace of suffrage under Emmeline Pankhurst. Ernst Rutherford was the first person to ever split an atom there at the University of Manchester in 1917. That backfired. And thanks to its long history of labor, really good scene for music. You've got Buzzcocks, you got the Smiths, Oasis, tons of great bands. And obviously, it's the home of the Manchester United Football Club. And I assume to our more savvy fans, they all would know the theme song to the Manchester United Football Club of "My baby takes the morning train. He works from 9 to 5, and then he takes another home again to find me waiting for him, watching the Manchester United football team."
Yay!
The football team in all the land. And if you don't get that reference, that's on you. Lastly, our Discord. Our Discord is the best place to come and complain to us. Honestly, it is that. You leave notes. I do read those, but if you come to our Discord, I'll respond. But more importantly, it's a great place to interact around 40K. That's the real reason we made the Discord. It's not because I have a weird ego and need to interact with people. I don't. If you guys never spoke to me, I'd be fine. I made the Discord.
I wouldn't.
And Brad, yeah, it wasn't that. The Discord, in my mind, exists really so I hate Reddit. I hate Daka Daka. I hate these forums because they're not inviting for people who have genuine questions that they just don't know the answer to. And they come in and they ask them and people are jackasses to them. Our Discord is built so that if you really do have an honest question and you just, you know, it can be, sorry, you just don't know something, you are going to get great support and answers within our Discord. That's what it's for. If you just want a place to hang out, people who have similar viewpoints, also come in and join our Discord. We've got memes, we've got gaming, we've got everything, but it's really built to be a positive, fun community. So come on in, join our Discord. It's just a great time. We're in there all the time. We've got a great set of moderators. It's just, please join Discord.
It's lovely.
Yeah. But with that, let's get back to the Night Lords, but we're going to take a little bit of a side journey because we have to go somewhere else first, because the whole theme of today's cast is how well the Night Lords screwed over Horus.
Also, because I love that there's so much that's going to happen back on McCracken a little bit, but you decided to spend the most time on Sotha. By far.
Everything's on, well, Kasotha's more interesting. Kasotha's actually more important. All right, let's talk about, of all the things that are going to happen in the, from what, we're at M31 right now, through M41, none of it happens if Sotha doesn't happen.
I would say that what happens on McCrag is better, because in his shit-talking, he gives them
nothing. McCrag doesn't happen without Sotha.
I mean, fine, he sneaks on board for weeks and weeks and weeks.
But they don't end up in McCrag without Sotha.
Sure.
There we go. That's my point. Sotha is actually the most important part. One of the, not most, it's one of the most important parts of the entire Horus Heresy. And was written, by the way, like 2 decades after they wrote the Horus Heresy. That's a side note. So, Sotha. I love this story. We covered a while back. We're going to touch it again. Sotha is a planet in the region of Ultramar, the greatest region in all of the galaxy. Under one of the under one of the mountains is a Necron pylon, and the Ultramarines discovered it at one point. They're trying to unlock its secrets. Although ironically, it actually wasn't even the Ultramarines; it was a warp smith from the Iron Warriors who was still loyal, named Dantioch. And all that they knew was that this structure somehow affected the Astronomicon in one way or another, but they couldn't fully understand why. After the destruction of the Night Lord fleet by the Dark Angels, or should I say the brutal ass-kicking of the Night Lord fleet by the Dark Angels, everyone fled. For whatever reason, the Mournival Point just outside Sotha is considered a blind spot to the Imperium, which sounds cool until we consistently remember that no scanners in all of 40K work ever. So, like, a blind spot in 40K is basically anywhere that a person is not actively looking out the window at. Calling it out right now. But anyway, the Night Lords decided that this one spot was going to be our super secret meeting point. And so a bunch of Night Lords all appeared right above Sotha, completely undetected by the Ultramarines. Weird.
It's because they're good at stealth, yo.
Or because no one ever detects anything in 40K.
I'm going to go with the Night Lords are good with stealth. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Unfortunately,
I said good day, sir.
Now, the Ultramarines below, the downside for them is the Night Lord fleet above them was a lot bigger than them. And this is during the stage. This is after Erebus had pulled off the ritual, so it's a massive warp storm everywhere. So warp communication is jacked. Warp travel is jacked. Sotha is an easy target. It is not well defended. There are Ultramarines there, but there's not a lot of them there. And the ability for the Ultramarines to get there quickly is minimal. And so the Night Lords, who are licking their wounds after genuinely getting the crap beaten out of them by the Night Lords, are looking for a victory. And a key element of this invasion, just from a story standpoint, for the Night
Lord. Master Zar, yo.
Yeah, Zar Siakar, whatever. I think it's, is it Siakar? Whatever. All right. And also, I hate the name Clawmaster. I just wish they just called them captains. Like,
you
Clawmaster.
Such a hater.
Well, they're like, oh, this guy's like, it's just some of the terms, something made up by an 8-year-old. I'm not a captain, I'm a Clawmaster. Shut up, dork. All right. Siakar was like especially butthurt after Thramis, but he's a little bit weird. Most of the Night Lords were just...
He's more standard Space Marine than a bunch of the others.
Well, no, he's more standard Chaos Space Marine.
Yes. He wants to be a warlord of a successful warlord band, effectively.
Exactly. Whereas the other Night Lords were on team like, hey, I was really enjoying pulling the eyeballs out of people, and now I can't. He was sitting there saying, I was about to be like the most glorious Claw Master ever. Why can't I? Why? I want to be better than this. So whatever, nerd. He then is part of this assembling of Night Lords. So they all get together and they discuss what they're going to do on Sotha. Siakar speaks up randomly and says, I'm going to lead the assault down there. My forces will conquer these guys, and I'm going to personally restore glory to the Night Lords. Basically using the word me a whole lot, which gets him some serious side eye from the other Night Lords of like, what's up with this dude? But whatever. So the Night Lords, by the way, didn't know what was on Sotha. They just knew there were Ultramarines there. And so they didn't realize what they were about to do and how big of a deal it was. So initial invasion goes pretty much as expected. Night Lords come pouring down and the Ultramarines respond with just stoic perfection. Organized and layered defenses kind of rip apart the first chunk of Night Lord attack because it's just disjointed, it's organized. But the Ultramarines know this is not going to work. There are way too many of them. By the way, every Ultramarine story involves the word rear and guard back to back. Every Ultramarine story. No one has as many red shirts as the Ultramarines. They love red shirts. I've debated remaking my Ultramarine army, but just painting them all with red shirts because the amount of Ultramarines that die in every story, you need a giant collection of red shirts. So they do a giant rear guard action while moving as many civilians as they can to evacuation. Where they evacuate them to in a ruin storm, I don't know. But that's the overall plan.
The reason that I hate that we're doing this, because yes, Sotha is, we got to talk about it. But you realize this entire story is literally based on an Ultramarine Centurion.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
This is his story. It is not a Night Lord story.
And?
I'm not bad.
Yeah, I'm not following. Oh, so it's better written.
As I prepared for this, I'm like, are we doing a lot of time on this one Ultramarine story?
Well, it's because of the conclusions. There's two conclusions to this. So anyway, the Ultramarines fall back. Attican Square, it's a choke point. And the Ultramarines put up their super defense. They put up a shield wall, you know, blah, blah, blah. Out of nowhere, a bunch of civilians come released into the square. And these are civilians the Night Lords had captured. The Night Lords had basically had sewn their eyes shut. I mean, they were just ripped apart. And they just, because they knew just to get them in the way of the Ultramarines. Then the Night Lords came out with their vehicles, all their predators. But out on top of their predators, the Night Lords had captured neophyte Ultramarines, and they'd flayed their, they were alive with their skin flayed, spread across the tanks, assuming the Ultramarines wouldn't shoot them because they wouldn't want to kill their neophytes. They were wrong, by the way. Ultramarines were like, whatever, I'm still blow up the stupid tank. Watch this.
Yeah, I mean, they did just shoot. You're like, hey, yeah, with a nice thank you after they got shot.
It's like, all right, like that dude's going to die anyway. Why don't I las cannon him? It seems like a better call. But eventually, as this is going, the Ultramarines are holding, but they're falling back. Once the Ultramarine defenses are about to break, Clawmaster Siakar strikes. He drives his Spartan heavy tank, which, are they still in the game or those go to Legends?
No, I wish they were still in the game. Those were awesome.
Yeah, those are cool. They would looked awesome. That's a lot of money for Snigs. That sucks.
Yeah, but I have to give, even though I hate that you made this an Ultramarine cast for a little bit, I have to give him props because, like, everything went to and the one, you know, Ekkar stood with them.
Oh, Ekkar stood in Centurion armor, just wrecking one Night Lord after another. But eventually, as Ekkar's fighting and fighting, this is the captain there, Sikar sneaks behind him and kills him, right? And
carves his mark into him.
And carves his mark into him and stands above him celebrating. As he's celebrating, though, all of the Terminator Night Lords around him turn and kill him And they did this because, that's why I want to talk about this story. They kill him because in the Night Lords, glory is unacceptable. Night Lords are there. There's no place for personal glory within the Night Lords. Vanity is worthless. Victory is only the willingness to wield a knife. And so the idea is because Sikar held himself back, let others fight in his place, and then snuck in at the end to try and claim victory for himself, he was not worthy of being a Night Lord. And so they killed him. That's why I went to that story, because I think it's a very cool story about one thing I do,
who the Night Lords are,
quote unquote, like about the Night Lords. They are not, they're not cowardly. You know, they'll run away from a fight, but like that, like, we're going to lose, let's get out of here. But that, like, dirty style is not their style. But Sikar's death, though, doesn't change anything with the with Sotha. Quite the opposite. On Sotha, they capture them.
Yeah.
Oh, they wreck it, and they end up capturing Dantioch. And Dantioch, who's the warp smith, they torture him. Dantioch knows that this Necron thing on the planet
Pharos
is important, but he doesn't know why. And while being just tortured and tortured and tortured, he gets concerned, basically, that the Night Lords don't know what this thing is, but if it falls into the hands of Horus, it's probably a bad thing. And Dantioch, by the way, he never could make this thing work, which tracks, because even M41, the Imperium can't make Necron technology work. So he makes this decision. He goes, you know what? No one's going to get a hold of this thing.
You know who thinks this was an epically bad idea? Everyone inside the galaxy, when they let off the welcome mat for the Tyranids.
Well, yeah. So this thing explodes. So he fires it off. It explodes and fires this giant, maybe the largest flash inside
the warp
in the history of the galaxy. Everything in the galaxy and in the warp can see it, including, yeah, the Tyranids. So this is why, when I talk about this, also why the first Tyrannic War hit Ultramar, because this was the point they were going towards. This is why this is so important. We don't get the Tyranids in the galaxy if it weren't for this. Now, back to Conrad. And Sotha's going to matter in a second. So after poking the bear that was the Dark Angels over and over again, the Night Lords tried to yell
a lot. We did not talk enough about the wild amount of shit.
Oh, it was horrifying what they were doing. Yeah. But then the Night Lords tried to yell not in the face and run away from the Dark Angels, at which point Conrad woke up and said, no, f- those guys, and went right back to the Dark Angels, who went, all right, I'll punch you in the mouth. And he led a boarding of the Invincible Reason, which, side note, I hate the naming mechanic in 40K. Like, you're a British company. I get these are older, but we're now coming into 11th edition. Can we please get a 40K equivalent of Bodhi McBoatface? Please? Just one. We've got Gaz coming back, right? How about Rock the Big Rock? I don't care. Just give me something. Give me a Bodhi McBoatface something in 40K. Just saying. All right. But in Conrad's little attack, everyone dies except for him, and he goes full John McClane inside the Invincible Reason, just crawling through air ducts despite being a freaking Primarch. Now, Brad likes this next story.
I do love this story.
And this next story is one of those many stories that when you read it, is well-written. It's cool. It's
cool.
And it's exciting. And when you take a step back and think about it, you go, oh, that's incredibly stupid. So the Dark Angels look around and they do a quick count of how many people entered their ship and how many dead bodies there were. And there's a key one missing. The Night Haunter.
The giant albino.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's hidden. But he's also a Primarch on the capital ship of the Dark Angels, which is their best ship. So there is a 9 foot tall, so 3 meter, 600 pound, 270 kilogram, warp infused being, is the only being on the ship who does not have the same genetic code as all the other ones on the ship. And their scanners apparently can't find this. The range and accuracy of eyesight at this point. So then the lion decides to do, there's an angry murder Primarch crawling through the air ducts of my ship. And he goes full-blown scary movie and decides, I know what to do. Let's all break up into small groups and find him. The only way this would have been better is if we had female Primarchs, because then we could have checked every box of scary movies.
They could have went, also, let's go in without our weapons and alone.
Yeah. Oh, my God. There was some like Metal Gear Solid of like, what's that noise? Probably nothing. Like long, dark hallway. Someone should go down there. Oh, no, my flashlight's dying. You know, smaller groups will help us track him down together. Like, what the hell? This the whole thing. It's well written. It's cool, but it's really stupid.
Cool. And by the way, he evades them for 16 weeks.
He evades them for a little bit. The lion gets pissed off, and the lion goes down there and spends 16 weeks looking for him, and he evades the lion for 16 weeks.
Yes.
That's the better part, where the lion is, I'm assuming, taking his sword and banging on things, saying, Conrad, no.
I'm assuming he did so much damage to his own ship. Just I actually see walls.
I take it the other way. I could see him knocking on doors saying, Conrad, then Conrad, that's the wall going, not in here, and lion walking away.
Just yelling, Marco. Yeah.
Bolo. Like, 16 weeks.
Like weird Benny Hill skin of running back
and forth. Anyway, like I said, these books can be funnier if you wanted them to be. But while all this is going on, the rest of the Dark Angel fleet, as in the ship he's on, is trying to get back to Terra. And there's a massive ruin storm. They cannot see Terra, but they're trying. Until eventually, astropaths get a glimpse of this bright light of the Astronomicon. So they go, awesome. They change course and they all beeline to it. And they get there, and they translate out of the warp, and they're promptly met by the Blood Angels, the Ultramarines, Sanguinius, and Gilliman in Ultramar. Because it was the explosion of Sotha, which is, again, why this explosion is so important. Because the Dark Angels would have just been lost if Sotha hadn't happened. This is the only reason why this stuff all occurs. They end up there.
This is a big deal in this, because at the time, Horus's plan was actually working. He did lead the Angels on a goose chase. He did isolate the Ultramarines, Space
and Force. The Blood Angels. The Blood Angels were stuck. Yeah.
Yep. Blood Angels. And then you remember, wolves are in the middle of nowhere, smashing Prospero. So none of these people are where they should be, which is being able to come back to Terra. So was working. So
it was going well. So they get there and the lion gets a call saying, hey, the two of your brothers are here. We're on Ultramar. Can you go say hi? So he has to go leave Conrad behind, at which Conrad also goes, cool, Ultramar sounds fun. And he also sneaks out. How he sneaks out and gets onto the surface, I don't know. I'm assuming
he made a bunch of drop pods shoot out.
Yeah. And my point is, I don't get it, because it's the same thing as the Family Guy version of Star Wars, where it's like, oh, it's an empty drop pod. Yeah. Like, don't shoot at it. I'm sorry, are we paying for these bullets? Bunch of drop pods went out. Yeah, we have guns, blow them all up. One of them has a Primarch in it, who's a really bad Primarch. We can end this story right now on page 7. Cool. This novel becomes a pamphlet like that.
Underestimate the powers of the Night Hunter.
Yeah. So we covered this before, but a quick recap on Imperium Secundus, aka the accidental coup. With the Ruben
Storm. This is one of my favorite. Well, let's set it up now, because they currently think that the Emperor is dead, Terra has fallen.
Well, it makes sense to them. They know, so Gilliman, Horus, and Sanguinius are together. They know Horus. They know how good he is. They know that Vulcan is dead, they think. They know that Ferris Manus is dead.
Dead.
They assume that Korax is dead.
That's good, because all of the Raven Guard, except for 50, are currently dead. Yes.
Exactly. The three of them are looking at each other with their entire legions. So that leaves White Scars, Space Wolves, maybe, and Rogue.
They also know that the Space Wolves were off in the middle of nowhere.
Best case scenario, the Space Wolves are there. So the best case scenario is the Emperor and three legions are sitting back on Terra against Horus and every and all of the traitor legions.
It's an auto lose.
It's an auto lose. So their assumption is Horus would have gotten home, would have gotten to Terra, and has just defeated the Emperor at this point. But the three of them possess the largest force in the galaxy, because what they do realize, because, you know, these are, as much as I blow up Gillen for being smart, Sanguinius and the Lion are also light years good generals, and they can do the math pretty quickly of, yeah, Horus probably got to Terra. Yeah, Horus probably won the battle. But Horus probably took some catastrophic losses getting there. We took no losses. So how about we go and beat the ever-living out of Horus? Like, oh my God, let's go do this. Because they don't know about the demon thing, obviously. They're not aware of, like, although you think Sanguinius might have, given what just happened to him. Side note. Yeah. But this is the plan. And I love this story because, obviously, I'm a Gilliman fan.
I was just about to say, just because he can talk a little shit to the Lion, basically.
Because the story's funny. Come on. Because they get there, the three of them get together, and Gilliman rolls out his 300-point PowerPoint about, here's what we're going to do. We're gonna make the new Imperium.
Yep.
Yeah, we're going to start. We're gonna use Ultramar will be the base because, look, we're already here. We'll make a new empire. We'll spread out from here. We'll reconquer the galaxy. We're going to beat the crap out of Horus. We're going to kill all the traitors. And we're going to follow through on what the Emperor originally wanted. We'll rebuild it back up from what it was. Yeah, it's a setback, but we got this, blah, 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 blah. And the Lion just gets all up and he goes, oh, and I assume you're going to be the new Emperor because, you know, blah, 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 Gilliman. And Gilliman goes, what? No, it'll be Sanguinius. And the Lion looks at him and goes, yeah.
I do love that the Lion's, because he wanted to be mad about it, because he's like, this is what you wanted all along, to, you know, supplant the Emperor. And then he goes, yeah, it's going to be Sanguinius. And you walk and you look at the angel floating and you're like, oh, yeah, that's probably better.
Fair enough. Yeah, like, yeah, that's seems, like,
we're probably going to put him on a lot of the money, right? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
for sure.
The Lion's response is, I have no notes.
Yeah.
Okay, fair.
It's like, well, that's a good choice.
Yeah. Well, okay. So back to the PowerPoint. What was step two? Because step one, we're in.
We'll be right back after a quick break. Earlier this year, I decided to upgrade my wardrobe. After well over a decade of dressing in stuffy business suits everywhere I went, I decided to upgrade into a more smart, casual approach at work. The problem was, I wanted a more comfortable and relaxed look, but had no idea how to make it. And that's where Quince came in. Quince has now become my go-to. The fits are clean, the fabrics feel nice, and everything just works without needing to overthink it. Quince has all the wardrobe staples for spring. Think 100% European linen shorts and shirts from $34, lightweight, breathable, and comfortable, but still look put together. And 100% Pima cotton tees with a softness that has to be felt. Their pants also hit with that same balance, relaxed and comfortable, but still polished enough to wear pretty much everywhere. Everything is priced 50 to 80% less than what you'd find at similar brands, because Quince works directly with ethical factories to cut out the middlemen, so you're getting premium materials without the markup. Refresh your everyday with luxury you'll actually use. Head to quince.com/40klore for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/40klore for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/40klore.
But meanwhile, Conrad decides to be Conrad. So Conrad sneaks onto McCraig, and he decides to do full anarchy burger, hold the government, and breaks out because he, and I can't figure out how he does this, by the way, because they say he leads a rebellion on McCraig. And like, this is the least charismatic Primarch by a mile.
I think there's on the most murder and blackmail going on.
Right, but on the most prosperous planet, in the most prosperous system, in the Imperium, if you want to rank out where you wanted to live in the Imperium at this stage in Imperial history, it might have been McCraig. And he's like, oh, yeah, I led a revolution on McCraig. No, you didn't. Just full stop. No, you didn't. They would have been like, we're going to revolt against Gilliman. The whole of McCraig would be like,
yeah.
No.
Too much talky-talky about this from John. Let's talk about the fact that the Night Hunter leads both G-Man and the Lion on a wild goose chase of him popping all over the place, causing shit with them right behind him and him doing backflips to get away. And then he leads him to a trap. I got to grease up the Erebus mustache real quick. And he basically leads them into the chapel, the fortress, the chapel.
Yeah, fortress. And then collapses it on them.
Well, it just explodes it. It wasn't just collapsed them. They had, if they didn't get teleported out, they were just going to die. He basically imploded the whole thing. He basically set off a fusion reactor where the bombs on top of them.
And then he gets weird, though. Then he goes after, so he thinks he's killed Gilliman and the Lion. By the way, does classic superhero or supervillain thing. Doesn't check. Just goes,
Well, he doesn't check. And then he goes, what should be the first thing instead of checking? Oh, let me go talk to G-Man's foster mom just to talk about Gilliman.
Yeah, who's randomly guarded by a bunch of space wolves. I never knew why, but he does kill all them. And then starts talking crap to her, at which point she just starts talking crap back to him.
You know, hold on, before you get there, because you skipped the over it because you didn't want to talk about it. Remember the time that both the Lion and Gilliman were fighting solo Conrad to a draw? Fighting
him, well, fine, because he was running away from them. I'll give Conrad credit. He can run away really well.
I'm just saying somebody was dueling around and not getting...
Like I said, I've never been able to figure out GW writing when it comes to Primarch fights. It makes no sense, but whatever. Anyway, I did like, though, yeah, he goes and meets Gilliman's foster mom and then complains about not having a mother himself. And it's, again...
Oh, by the way, like a long diatribe about this, by the way.
It's a lot. It's like, Conrad, you were on a planet. You could have made friends. You chose to murder everybody. Like, it wasn't like, you know, Angron didn't have a lot of choices. He was kidnapped and thrown in a fighter pit, and he still made friends with the other people in the fighter pit. Conrad was wandering around a city and went, I'll just start killing people. And later was like, no one would be my friend. Yeah, man. Kind of a dick. So anyway. So eventually, you know, Conrad became enough of annoyance for the Lion that the Lion goes, hey, I have an idea. We know where Conrad is, right? And Gilliman goes, yeah, we do.
Crazy Vulcan.
Well, what? Oh, fine. They do find Vulcan.
No, Vulcan literally shows up and starts rage smashing on Conrad.
That's not on Conrad. He starts rage smashing because Conrad's nearby. I forgot about it. He's like a divining rod for Conrad.
He's and just walking in a straight line towards wherever he is.
Yeah, like wherever Conrad
just this is the time when Vulcan's still totally nuts, but they eventually.
Yeah, I forgot. So this is for back to the last cast. This is when Vulcan has now reformed after burning up in the atmosphere. Fun phone call, by the way, Gilliman gets. I'm like, hey, by the way, Vulcan's also here. And like, well, how did he get here? We don't know, but he's here. And he's really messed up. Like, oh, he's beat up? No, his brain no goody.
Brad bad. He's got Brad brain going on.
Oh, yeah. He's had all of the strokes. But he's really upset about something. What's that? Conrad. And he's looking for him. So Vulcan's just raging through McCraig, and eventually they had to like
subdue him. Grammaticus,
the Kabbalist show up. Yeah, and
I always want to say this, so I can always say instead of Grammaticus, I can say John Irenicus from Baldur's Gate 2. But he basically stabs him with a fulgurite.
Well, with fulgurite, the idea is to remove Vulcan's ability to be a perpetual, which doesn't work
at all.
Yeah, but it does remove Grammaticus's. It's a whole thing. We covered it. The problem is the issue is it's newer lore, so it's a little bit wonky. Grammaticus is a newer element to the 40K lore series, and we're going to have to do a whole cast on Grammaticus because it's interesting. I do like where they went with it, but it was wedged in a little bit, if I'm being honest.
This is also like a tiny spot of the story. They basically go, hey, Vulcan's doing nutty shit. Grammaticus shows up and stabs him, and basically everybody.
I need to check the books. It's possible that was added after these books were written. Yeah, I have to check.
Because Conrad attacks Grammaticus, and then he basically does a smoke bomb.
Well, what I'm wondering is, I'm actually trying to figure out the date, the order of those books may have come out. That book with Grammaticus may have come out after the Night Hunter books.
Because what happens is this, because he's talking to his mom, mm-hmm. and then Vulcan shows up and goes buck wild. Grammaticus gets rid of Vulcan, and then Vulcan's like, I want the Fulgurite. Conrad wants the Fulgurite, and then they banish him to the warp, the dude with him. And Conrad thinks he's gone for weeks and weeks and weeks, but it's just like moments. But he actually comes back in the capital.
Yeah. And at that point, this is one of my favorite. See, now it's one of my favorite parts of the whole thing. Because this, again, I find conversations between the Lion and Gilliman always hilarious. I'm glad we're getting some new ones coming up. Because Conrad is in the capital.
Very next thing coming on.
Yeah, yep. Causing problems. And Gilliman goes to the Lion goes to Gilliman, hey, we know where Conrad is, right? Gilliman goes, yeah. And Lion goes, he's kind of a pain in the ass to capture, right? Gilliman goes, yeah. And Lion goes, I got a great idea. What do you say we just bomb the hell out of the general vicinity that he's in, and that'll kill him? To which Gilliman says, that general vicinity is the capital of McCraig. And the Lion goes, yeah. And Gilliman has to go, not cool, man. Not cool. So the Lion goes, fine, and grabs his Dreadwing and sends them down to flush Conrad out. And then, this next scene. All right. I don't know why GW loves to perform IP violation, but they do. This next scene is a ripoff of Demolition Man, Batman versus Superman, Aliens, Star Wars, and a bunch of other movies all at the same time. So Conrad is leading an attack in the city, around the city, and as the main building is burning, that's when the Lion appears, and they fight each other inside of a collapsing, burning structure. Because of course they do. This time, and of course, and there's all the pieces, back and forth fight and bad guy monologue. The Lion gives the Obi-Wan Kenobi of how could you, Anakin, to which, you know, Conrad replies, he says, why return the Emperor? And the Conrad goes, why not? I don't, you know, whatever. And basically says he's accepted that he's a monster. He was made to be a monster. He's just being the monster that he's supposed to be. And the Lion goes, all right, fine, fair enough. Grabs him, doesn't get his throat slit this time, pulls his power pack off. I don't know why, because it's a weird order of operation.
They had to give him the 11 fingered death punch, dude.
Well, the thing is, right, but my point is, the 11 fingered death punch works with or without the power pack. That's more my thing. Like, he rips the power pack off, like, oh, he took his power pack off, and then breaks his back over his knee. Power pack or no power pack, that second part's the key part there. Also, what's up with GW and breaking people's backs over knees?
Sometimes you get a Bane a guy.
It comes up a lot. Yeah. Like, not a lot, but it's like the nickel thing. If it's happened, I'd have two nickels, which is not a lot, but still. So he then drags paralyzed Conrad back to Gilliman and Sanguinius. With Conrad back, the Primarchs, this part gets weird. So first they interrogate him.
I'll say it gets weird because Conrad decides to go full. He put all of his points into talking right here.
Yeah.
He does a really good job of being a dick, basically. I mean, he just.
Oh, yeah.
He's just trying to stir up shit.
Yeah. His whole purpose is just to be a pain in the butt. And he goes back into this whole thing of like, I am who I am. The Emperor made me this way. Therefore, everything I've ever done in the history of my entire being is because it's what the Emperor wanted, which is, again, I mentioned this last time, Calvinism. So I need, if someone at GW listens to this cast, please just message me, send it privately, who there has the master's degree in religion? Just, I know one of you has it. Because you hit Calvinism, you hit baptism, you hit a lot of Protestant beliefs really well, really specifically to certain structures on a lot of your Primarchs at a level that's just too eloquent. And I need to know who's doing this because I'm very impressed. That's all. Just saying it for the record, I'm very impressed. But as Conrad's screwing with them, he decides to kind of get them to turn on each other. And he convinces Gilliman that the lion actually did bomb McCraig. And killing, obviously, civilians.
And he talks a shit ton. He wild him on a shit to Sanguinius also.
Yeah. The lion then freaks out and goes to go stab Conrad. Sanguinius steps in the middle and says, you can't kill him, which is ironic because of what's going to happen next. And then Gilliman grabs the lion's sword and breaks it over his leg. At which point, the lion decides to take his ball and go home. Grabs his legion.
I love
and just leaves. That's what he does. He's like, all right, well, screw you guys. And he leaves. And Conrad has successfully broken up the triumvirate, sort of, but not really, because we'll get to more of that in a second. Sanguinius then grabs Conrad to go execute him because, remember, Conrad did kill a ton of people. He's led horrific actions, killing trillions of citizens. He killed a bunch of Dark Angels. He led a revolution on McCraig. He tried to kill the lion a bunch of times. So, yeah, death penalty.
Almost successfully killed the lion and G-Man. If they had to get teleported to Pharos.
We're pretty much on death penalty here is probably a go. But as Sanguinius is about to kill Conrad, the lion teleports in. There's a whole story there, but it's not really important. The lion's able to find his way. He teleports in and goes, hey, hold on. And he goes, and this whole bit is, again, funny to me. He goes, it's not that Conrad doesn't deserve to die, but, because he does, Conrad's a precog. And he's completely sure that Conrad would die at the hands of an assassin sent by the Emperor.
Well, let's back this up a little bit because of the fact that he's basically telling him that, because that's why a lot of people say that Conrad never fell to chaos. He was just against the Imperium because he says his dad, all of this doesn't work. He's against you. He's using you. He's making you do these things. And goes to confirm that I am going to die at the hands of an assassin sent by the Emperor. And that's one of the things he's pointing out. And then he also talks about the fact that he's seen Sanguinius's death on Horus's ship and tells all these guys this. And the lion realizes that, wait a minute, if he's so sure that the Emperor is going to kill him, that means the Emperor is just not dead.
Yeah.
And we need
to together. Well, that's part one of the story. That part's okay. That makes sense. Part two of this is the funnier part. At that moment, Sanguinius goes, oh yeah, I am also a precog.
Yeah.
And I also have a fate.
Yeah, I've also seen this.
Yeah, where my fate is that I will die next to the Emperor protecting him. And that hasn't happened yet either. So, hey, the Emperor must be alive. Freaking idiots. And so all of a sudden, everyone is on team. We can see the future and the fates are real. So they decide not to kill Conrad and then awkwardly realize they just did a coup. They have that little moment of like, oh, yeah, but let's all, so then they go, you know, Captain Planet style, let's all go to Terra, hooray. And they have to bring Conrad with them because of two reasons. One, you cannot leave him behind. He will do horrible things. And B, they want to kind of use his precog powers, like, I don't know, some like Rosetta Stone. I can't figure out the concept, but they bring Conrad along. And the three loyalists, though, have a problem. They get on the ships, and like, we're going to go to Terra, and they can't see Terra. So that's not going to work. But thanks to Sanguinius, they can see Davin, which is the place that Horus went to get corrupted. So they go, all right, we're going there. And Sanguinius, because Sanguinius had a vision to take them there. And they get to Davin, which is this whole thing on Davin. I just don't like this story very much because it's just really convoluted and incredibly complicated. But in effect, Sanguinius goes full. They get to Davin. The planet is chaos corrupted. And Sanguinius decides, I have to go down to the surface of Davin to figure out what's going on. And I have to bring Conrad with me. And the Dark Angel's like, no, you don't. And Sanguinius goes full Professor Xavier and goes onto the Dark Angel's ship and uses his mind bullets to incapacitate a bunch of Dark Angels and then takes Conrad down to the planet. Conrad, by the way, was laughing his ass off the whole time. Like, he, look at me, my superpower. Then the line gets up and bombards them, but doesn't kill anybody. Whatever. It's not important for this, but the whole thing on Davin gets real ugly because it is, it's Davin's very, we'll go with warpy. It's a little warp infused as a plant.
It's a little warp infused?
Little warp infused.
I would say that it's 50% family packed warp infused.
Yeah, it's not ideal. And demons come out, whole big thing. Sanguinius gets pulled into the warp. The lion and Gilliman have to save him. Conrad out of nowhere goes to help and decides to go loyalist for a period of time.
Everybody
helps them out.
Love Sanguinius. Just accept that.
It's fine. But what does happen, the most important part about this is because thanks to Conrad's help, that's the key part here. They do rescue Sanguinius. There's an assault comes in from other Chaos Space Marines, but this creates a gap in the Ruin Storm and they can see Terra, but it's a narrow gap. And so they all look at Sanguinius say, you go. We're going to hold. And so Sanguinius grabs Conrad at the last second,
yep.
And they all hit back.
Snatches him. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, this is a big deal for Conrad at the time. And I think that he's at so many points where he could have done the right thing and he does wildly the wrong thing again because he's being shown right here because he doesn't see any of the things that are going. He's never foreseen some of these things.
Yeah.
It should be a point where he could say that I could change the future. What I'm seeing isn't exactly what could happen, but he does not. You know what I mean? And he does do the right thing. He helps Sanguinius out, and then he immediately kind of goes despair mode and full emo for a bit because of the fact that he doesn't know what to do. Well, he also says, hey, man, remember, because we talked about this in the last cast, which is, he's doing a lot of this monstrous stuff in his mind because he's foreseen that he becomes a terrible monster. And now he's got the whole, hold on. Maybe I didn't have to be a monster.
He never did
be a monster.
Yeah. Yes. Which is true, but he's still a horrible monster and deserves horrible exactly.
I'm not saying that he's not. I'm just saying that this is where he is in his headspace right now. He's got the realization that, hey, maybe I wasn't forced and predestined to be this horrible thing. I just am. I chose to be this horrible thing. And then he has to deal with that fact of, oh, I'm just awful. I wasn't forced to be awful. I wasn't destined to be awful. I just am. Yeah. He has that look in the mirror of like, oh, this is all my fault. And then he loses that a little bit later. Don't worry about it. He stays with that for about 10 seconds and then goes, nah, this is definitely not my fault.
I do like that while they're blasting back to Terra, Sanguinius grabs Conrad and walks over to an escape pod and shoves him in it and goes, look, man, your fate's your fate. Good luck.
Well, he puts him in a stasis pod.
Yeah.
And just launches him out like of,
yeah.
You're like, hey, man, I'm going to make, no one will ever probably pick you up or someone will, and it'll definitely come back to haunt them. Screw you, Sanguinius. You could have killed him right there.
Yeah.
The people on board that ship are going to be real bummed.
Oh, yeah. We'll get to what happens. This is not ideal for a very certain salvage vessel. But he just, Sanguinius is, it's kind of cool what he says. He basically says, look, Conrad, you believe that your fate is fixed. Let's find out. Here you go. I'm casting you out and we'll let the fates do what they will. I got stuff. Basically, I got shit to do. I got time to watch you. So, now, with all this going on, there are some Night Lords left. And the funny story about this is there are Night Lords who take part in the invasion of Terra. And this is actually what I get a kick out of is, like, they're actually not that bad compared to the Emperor's children. They do some stuff.
You compare those and you went, I mean, what they're doing? Luxury compared to what the Emperor's children did.
Yeah, they're actually fighting against the Space Marines there. The Emperor's children were the ones who were like, this place.
They're at the gap, baby.
Yeah, it's totally undefended. All right, cool. I mean, I am sure there are some Night Lords who are like, we're Abercrombie and Fitch. Like, all right, well, those guys got the gap, but we're going to Abercrombie and Fitch. I'm grabbing a couple, like, right? This will still be fun. But at the end of the Heresy, though, this is what more matters. End of the Heresy, almost all of the traitors go back to the Eye of Terror, except for the Night Lords.
Night Lords have no loyalty to any Chaos God.
Well, there's nowhere to go. They go with what I call Plan E for Eastern Fringe.
Well, yeah. They also just never, they currently don't have a leader, and they also never accepted any particular god. They have no patron. So,
well, yeah, and the Eye of Terror is actually would in theory be bad for that. If they were to go into the Eye of Terror, there's no value. It's a realm of gods who hold nothing for them. They have no loyalty to. They would actually lose power in effect by going in there. So instead, they just go to the very edge of the galaxy, which is ironic for the Tower. Fun story there. The Tau would be eventually. It's actually before the Tau were even there, just to kill and torture. They're like, all right, we're going to go out here. They basically went on vacation, is how I would look at it. They were like, look, it's been a long fight.
A murder hobo vacation?
Yeah. Well, that's what it was. It had a long, long couple years of work here. It's been a big one. You know what? We're going to go on an all-inclusive. We're going out to the Eastern Fringe to just do our thing. And they get out there and just begin their little campaign of terror, raiding planet systems, not for supplies, just to harm people. And they're out there for a bit until they eventually meet an old friend. But it takes a while to get there. Conrad and his dumb stasis pod of doom.
Now, so, real quick, this is where the book starts. And Conrad Kerr's The Night Hunter. And it's told in a wildly non-linear path. And I want to say this to people before they, because I say it's one of my favorites. But it's also told in a wildly non-linear fashion. So you have to get started reading into it. But it's a good read.
Yeah. So there's a salvage ship. Because this is a ripoff of Alien, Deep Rising, and kind of Deep Star 6. If you've seen any of those movies, this is what this is a pull from. Salvage ship is moving around and sees a stasis pod and decides to go salvage said stasis pod. Not a good move. So
no.
They open the stasis pod.
They were so excited that they were going to get so much money for him. And then things did not work out for them.
Yeah. So he wakes up out of his stasis and enters the ship. And proceeds not to kill everyone, he does, but to do it piece by piece, pure horror movie style.
And leaves each one for the others to find before they will do something to the next one. And he kills them in bad, bad ways. Like,
yeah, he was in a mood. He was in a bad temper.
Yeah. Yeah. Like they find a lot of the people and you're like, I don't even know how this is even possible to have that.
Yeah, it's bad. But there are two key parts of this ship, though. The ship's called by the Sheldroom. Part number one is that one of the crew members was an Imperial assassin, because at some point, Malkador and the Emperor had issued an order to the entire Calidus Temple to go find and kill Conrad. The entire temple. So they had spread throughout the entire galaxy looking for him. And so one of the crew members was a Calidus assassin. And when they came upon him, they had sent a note back saying, I found him. They don't survive, by the way. This Calidus assassin very much so dies.
Like, epically, by the way.
Yeah, doesn't go well. But now the Calidus temple is aware of Conrad's existence, and they know the name of the ship that Conrad's on, which means they can track the ship. Part number one. Part number two, Conrad does leave one crew member alive named Elver. That's right. And it basically is Conrad just doesn't feel like flying the ship himself. So he goes, all right, you're going to fly the ship.
Makes him listen to him for
years. Yeah. And this dude spends, is it 4 years or six years?
I think it's four on it.
It's something like that, because the ship doesn't have a warp drive. So this poor dude has to sit there. Yeah, it is 4 years, and spends 4 years listening to Conrad whine about how unfair the universe is to him.
Well, here's a big thing on this is because, well, spoiler, as soon as they get to their destination, he's like, thanks for listening to me. Hey, guys, smoke this dude.
Oh, yeah. This is 100% one of those things of that dude knows all of my deep, dark secrets.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons, because he said shit to other people and just did not care. The problem is that he explained to Elver that he had doubts in his visions before he said, remember, we were talking about how until the Sanguinius incident, he had firm 100% belief. This is my future. I've seen it. I can't do anything about it. I'm just embracing all these things that are going to happen to me. And then he had that moment of doubt, and it stuck with him for this entire trip to their mm-hmm. secret fortress. And he had told this dude all about it. And when they got there, he's like, well, thanks for listening to my stories. Put this dude in an airlock and launch him somewhere.
Yeah. Now, Conrad gets the Eastern Fringe. The thing about the Eastern Fringe is Sagualsa, which is actually the world where he had the lion meet him, yep. was secretly a Night Lord base. Because again, scanners don't work. So Night Lords were able to build an entire base somewhere. And they built this giant, I don't know, center there. And from this center, Conrad gets there, puts out the call, all the Night Lords come meet him. And they launch a genocide campaign on the Eastern Fringe.
That he's trying to make sure that the Imperium knows. He's trying to, again, self-fulfill his prophecy. That's what I'm saying.
This is horrifying what happens.
He turns it to 11, Spinal Tap style.
Oh, yeah. And
wants everyone to know that he's... Because right before he got there, the Night Lords were doing all this shit. But they were doing it in hit and runs, making sure people didn't know where they were going back to.
No, that this is a campaign.
Wants people to know that he's there.
This is a campaign of horror. I mean, like, and again, we're not talking like Dark Angels when they were the First Legion, like wiping out stuff. This is scary, like real bad stuff. They are basically bathing in blood, for lack of a better phrase.
Well, and that half of the Nightlords we were talking about. You know, like Sevatar and the group that just didn't, everybody wants nothing to do with the Night Hunter now. He's just, obviously, he's completely went off the reservation.
Oh, he's lost his mind. At this point, his whole like 4 years talking to Elvers where he's, I have doubts, those went out the window. He gets here and just becomes a monster. Monster upon monster. And I think you may be right. This may be like, you know, death by cop, or suicide by cop style.
I 100% believe that because he had all those doubts and basically, again, he justified the fact that he was a monster by, I was made to be a monster. I was always going to be a monster. This is my destiny. And then he found his doubts. And then he's like, I'm going to force myself correct and say my destiny was to be a monster. My destiny was to be killed by an assassin sent by my father. And he's making this happen so that he's not wrong. I mean, he sits in front of that effigy that he made of the Emperor, which was banana town, by the way. It's part.
Yeah,
of
this is this is
to, he makes
he,
a
he sews people together.
Yeah, he sews people together. Just as a and through the book, he has a talk with his father, air quotes, about how he wronged him and he shouldn't have let him do this. And if he basically knew he was going to be a monster, why wouldn't he have stopped him unless this is what he was supposed to be and how it's not his fault? He's forcing his self-fulfilling prophecy. He is making this happen because I think that he had a moment where he had the doubt with back when he went and saved Sanguinius that, hey, this is my fault. You know what I mean? I really think it doesn't make him less of a monster, but he has that self-realization and he doesn't like it. So he goes back fully, basically cannonballs into the pool of madness and just goes, nope, was not my fault. See, it was always destiny.
Yeah. Well, let's get to the end of Conrad then. As we said before, the Calidus Temple knew where he was and they tracked the ship. So they knew everything about him. And so one of the assassins does eventually get there, named M'Shen, whatever. And Ryzen Salgas, T-S-A-S-G-U-A-L, screw you, G-W.
Just going with the Sa.
Sagualsa, and gets there and infiltrates the temple. Now, everyone.
Are you going to give the air quotes, John? Come on.
Infiltrates. I was going to get there. Now. When we say infiltrates the temple, yes, she's a Calidus assassin. Yes, she's got all these things. But this is a Primarch who has spent his entire life knowing he will be murdered one day by an Imperial assassin.
Also, it's
is a psyker. Yeah. Is a psyker. So yeah, he knew. And not only did he know she was there, but we know that he knew she was there because the last thing he says, now this is recorded, is he says to her as she's like stalking him and getting closer. He says, "Your presence does not surprise me, assassin. I have known of you ever since your craft entered the Eastern Fringe. Why did I not have you killed? Because your mission and the act you are about to commit proves the truth of all I have ever said or done. I merely punish those who had wronged, just as your false emperor now seeks to punish me. Death is nothing compared to vindication."
Yeah, this is what I'm saying. He's forcing this. Also, he could have smoke showed this assassin at any point.
Oh, yeah, he would have. I mean, that's the thing. There's no question. No Imperial assassin is equal to a Primarch. No. But now there's all... They've written this a few different ways, but there is a debate over when M'Shen actually does kill Conrad, because the only video evidence is M'Shen leaping at Conrad.
And then the video cuts.
And the video cuts. But there's also the story later is that Conrad told his legion, "I will be killed by an assassin." And he told his legion, "Do not pursue the assassin after they kill me." And he wanted that because this is his destiny. He wanted his dead body going back to the emperor as proof.
Vindication.
Yes. He wanted all this stuff.
He wants to show, I was always right. This is, again, because I really feel that it goes into the fact that he wants to go, I could not have done anything less or anything different because however, I was destined.
Yeah. However, so M'Shen cuts his head off. That much we know. But after cutting his head off, M'Shen also grabs some of the relics of the Night Lords, including some of Conrad's weapons. That sets off a few of the Night Lords, including Talos Valcorin.
She stole mercy and forgiveness.
Yeah, not cool. So as she basically does these, she starts running out and starts getting pursued. And then like the pursuit grows into more and more until she's being pursued by the entirety of the Night Lord Legion. She escapes for a period of time until she's eventually, they catch up to her. And the one who does catch her is Talos Valcorin. Talos was an apothecary in the 8th Legion. And then that job was considered lame. So he just went over to being a terror troop because... you know, nothing's
on. How did he kill her though?
He does kill her in a very fun way. First, he screams into her face, which stuns her. And then he spits acid. It's one of the few stories we do get of a space marine spitting acid. He does actually use the gland. He spits acid into her face, which melts her face. And then he rams her through with his chain sword. But even doing this, Primarch's still dead. And that has consequences. The death of Conrad, like most legions, is not great for the legion. They don't get the psychic break that you see. Although, to be fair, the psychic break of a legion only happened, from what I'm aware of, 2 times, where you had it with the Iron Hands and then the Blood Angels. I'm not aware of it other times, but other Primarchs have died. So, anyway. What you do get is the legion breaks apart. The Night Lords become... nothing more than war bands.
They're bands.
Yeah. And the funny part about this that I like is they kill M'Shen. They all go back to the Eastern Fringe. And they're having this grant. And they're like, whatever. We'll just go back to the murder fight. What timing isn't ideal for this, though. Because while they're doing the whole murder fight, back on Terra, all the Primarchs are there now. Of the loyalists, well, not the dead one, but all the loyalist ones are there. And they have a discussion about what should we do. And they decide we should go get some revenge. Gilliman's like, guys, I'll stay back and clean up the place. Go ahead. And they go tearing butt out into the galaxy to kick ass. And as they're doing all this butt kicking, all the traitors eventually run to the Eye of Terror, where is the one place all the loyalists can't go. Except the Night Lords aren't in there. And they all go, oh, they're not in there. So one day, Night Lords are having a little party, you know, skinning some children alive, because that's what they do.
A party.
Yeah.
skinning children party.
Yeah. And out of nowhere, a giant... well, this is post the Codex Astartes, so the Ultramarines show up with all of their second founding chapters. They did it officially, but it's basically the Ultramarines show up. It's like them in every single second founding chapter. So in effect, the entirety of the Ultramarines show up and just put on the ultimate of ass kicking. And the Night Lords all have to run away. And because they just go, nope, and bail. And this is actually the moment where the Night Lords do go into the Eye of Terror because they have nowhere to go. They are now, because they're on the Eastern Fringe. Where else are you going? So they have to run, and they're basically looking for, hey, where can we go? And someone sends a call like, just come over to come to the dark side. Like, all right, we'll go there. And this is actually the time where they pseudo-join Chaos. They never give themselves over to a Chaos God. Well, never. But this is the part where, up until this moment, they weren't part of like the demonic air quotes forces of chaos. It was after this point they had no choice but to. And so then they become, you know, whatever it is. Fun story though, one of my favorite ones is Osala, the planet they had it is. Once the Ultramarines get there, they
I
never
think you meant to say Darkana.
Whatever. Yeah, they didn't exterminatus it. So many, many, many years later, M41, just a little funny side story. A Imperial like colony ship got taken like whatever off course because of a ruin storm, found the planet, didn't know, I guess, what it was, and were like, oh, this planet's not that bad, and they settled it. Lived there for 500 years until the Night Lords got back to what used to be their home planet, saw a bunch of Imperium citizenry there and went, yeah.
Nope.
You... bad call. This is 100% Goldilocks and the Three Bears, but a lot worse. But they're polar bears. Like, bad thing. But let's close out with a little discussion about Night Lords post-death of Conrad, because this is actually important. So, as I said earlier, they become what I think of as the Starscream of 40K. They're, you know, there's a lot of stories.
Yeah, but they're in a lot of other people's stories. The Night Lords exactly. are antagonists in a bunch of novels and a bunch of other people's, especially when you read the codexes. Night Lords yeah. are a lot of the foils for right. all of this. And they do some real work, though, because they're really...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Abaddon has everybody. There's a story for Abaddon putting in every Legion, but they do a ton with Huron, for instance, Huron yeah. Blackheart. And they're in a lot of people's stories. When somebody wants to heroically save the citizens in the chaos, it's almost always the Night Lords that
are. Yeah. The Night Lords, they've got a ton of named characters. They're actually, it's funny. I think they're one of the most fleshed out Chaos Space Marine chapters who I believe will never get their own codex.
Which is sucky because they should.
No, they shouldn't because they couldn't. The issue is they're a weird chapter like that because there's not actually enough of them to give them their own chapter. Like, what unique units would you give them? Raptors and then...
I mean, they'd have to have different style raptors and shit.
But that's all it would be. It's, oh, look, another jump pack unit.
They have their own.
And
they
a
have
third them. Jump pack unit and a fourth jump pack unit. That's all my point is. Like, they're not different enough, but they are in a lot of books. And they have some great stories of, you know, there's a story where they realized they could create their own warp beacons by capturing a bunch of astropaths and torturing them, like really badly torturing them. They would actually create false beacons in the warp. So they did this and like hundreds of astropaths, they torture the hell out of them. And then a bunch of merchant vessels just translate in thinking, oh, cool, we're at our destination. And they translate in right in front of a bunch of Night Lord like warships and go, all right, well, this is not ideal. Like that's a Night Lord story. Or one of the really funny ones, not really funny, but tragic, is this small flotilla sneaks out of the Eye of Terror and makes it all the way basically almost to Terret. There's a
solar segmentum solar for sure.
Yeah, there's a Schola Progenium that's 100 light years from Terra, which is not far, by the way. And the Schola Progenium, they sneak in and they kill everyone in it. So the Schola Progenium is where like all the orphans, because a lot of them go. This is where you make Sisters of Battle, it's where you make commissars, they all come out of this. And they go there, they kill them all. And they assemble their corpses in a way that turns into a chaos ritual. And they turn the Schola Progenium planet into a demon world.
Yep.
And then bail back out. Imperium, by the way, didn't think that was cool. But that's the kind of stuff that they do.
One of my favorite things is the fact that the Night Lords, just like their Primarch, have the ability to piss people off so much that they actually make them shirk their duties because they
get Dark Angels matches. And Howling Griffins have both abandoned campaigns in Cadia to go hunt down the Night Lords because they were like, no, they all died today.
Sick of your shit, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Another funny one was they worked with the Alpha Legion. This was a classic one. There was an Orc Wa attacking Imperial citizens. So them and the Alpha Legion disguised themselves. They beat back the Orcs. The Imperial citizens were like, thank you. Our saviors opened their doors and turned off the defenses and then discovered it was Night Lords.
Just like,
yeah,
you guys are dicks. Also, your plans are so convoluted. Why are we doing this? Yeah.
The unfortunate part that I'll close on with Night Lords is because of some of the problems of 7th and 8th edition 40K, Night Lords kind of suck to play on the tabletop. And I say that because Night Lords are meant to be played as a warband. They're meant to be an ancillary piece of your forces when you're playing Chaos.
It's also the problem is, right now, their entire thing's based on battle shocking people, and battle shock's a bad mechanic.
Right. But what I'm saying, like, the truth is, if you think about how Night Lords would interact, the way that 40K is played in the tabletop, a 2,000 point army is, yes, it's small, but it's really meant to represent a large force. It's kind of how we think of it. The Night Lords don't fight like that. The Night Lords would meant to be, you should just have Night Lord Raptors should be part of your Chaos Space.
You know what Night Lords play really well in? Night Lords play really well in Kill Team.
Kill Team, exactly. Oh, 100%. And so unfortunately, as much as the Night Lords are kind of cool, they don't play well in the tabletop because they're just not meant for that. They're meant to be a ancillary force. You're supposed to have your Black
Legion. People are going to be mad at you for this.
They can be mad, but they're not, because they're going to agree with me, because they're going to sit there and say, it was better playing Night Lords. Well, they do, but they're going to agree with me that, it was better playing Night Lords when I could bring Night Lords and, because they were awesome as Night Lords and. Night Lords, a fast attack, sneaking Night Lord, it's the same thing the army we're going to cover next week, so I have the exact same situation. They were better as an and. As a solo, every now and then they're good, but they're really good as an and force. So, just calling it out. But we will break. Next week, we're staying on the stealth theme, but we're going loyalist. We're going with someone where the Legion was all nightmare, murder, and killy, and decided to stop being that. So we're going into Raven Guard. Yay, loyalists.
Shedamar.
Ooh, Istvan Five. Ooh, Istvan Five. Maybe Carcharodons. So Raven Guard. I thought it'd be kind of a nice 1-2 combo, because it is a nice comparison in that Yeah, because both legions have a very similar origin story, but one of them decided no, and just simply put.
One of us in their redemption arc is currently kind of a bad guy.
No, he's not.
Korx is a psycho in the warp right now.
Who's he killing?
Well, he's killing bad guys.
There we go. That's the thing. Korx, this is the funny thing. In the first cast, we talked about how on Nostromo, Conrad was kind of like the Punisher or, whatever, or Batman. Korax 100% is the Punisher right now. Or maybe actually he's more Spawn is what he is in the warp.
It's awesome. He's 100% a Demon Primarch right now.
But a good Demon Primarch.
Fully warp infused. I'm not saying he's bad. I'm just saying he is.
But my point is, he is in the warp. It's him and Drago, right? Is the Grey Knight one? It's him and Drago are wandering the warp, just slaughtering demons. Calling it out. It's kind of cool.
Doing it because he's beast mode and Korax is impossible to detect now.
Yeah. Korax is awesome now. Korax is like
perma invisible. Yeah. Just showing up places.
Yeah. Korax and Sanguinius are the only two Primarchs they cannot bring back because there's no rule set you could give them.
No. he would have loan up 1 inch.
Yeah. So Korax cannot be fought.
Yeah.
Huh? What do you mean? So, but does he get to attack? Yeah. So he's a vortex mine. Yeah, basically.
that moves 60.
Yeah, this seems unfair. Yeah, it kind of sucks.
Meh.
But anyway, so that'll be next week. We'll start on them. It'll be 2 to 3 casts. I never know until I write them. So until then, John Barsotti, Brad Chester.
This guy.
See you guys then.